now, Faith Unscripted with Pastor Rich.
Being with us for another version of Faith.
Well, Pastor, I believe you're cutting out a little bit there.
I'm sorry. Better?
A little bit, yeah.
Let me try this. How's that? Is that better?
Much better.
Okay, thank you very much. Thanks to everybody for being with us for today's show, today's version of Faith Unscripted, which is a little different because I am coming to you today from Pella, Iowa, by telephone. So if there's a little bit of a disconnect in our audio, it's because my iPhone is not behaving well. But I want to tell you that Pella, Iowa is just an absolutely beautiful place. If you haven't put it on your bucket list of places to visit, I certainly would do so immediately. I'm here in Pella because I'm a delegate to the Reformed Church in America's General Synod. So a little bit of explanation about what a General Synod is and why it meets. The General Synod in the Reformed Church is an annual gathering of delegates from Reformed churches around the country. And its task is to give guidance to the church for the ensuing year. So we vote on proposals and recommendations that are brought to us by committees of the Reformed Church. And so it's a deliberative body, but it's also a spiritual body. So there's a lot of worship. There's a lot of opportunity to meet and pray with other ministers and other believers from different parts of the country and even different parts of the world. And this year, the General Synod is occurring in Pella, Iowa. Why Pella, you may ask? Well, let me tell you. Pella is a beautiful little town that was founded by Dutch settlers in 1847. The word Pella itself, or the name of the town, is from an ancient city in what is today Jordan, and it's a city of refuge. The Pella in Jordan was a place where Christians went to escape persecution. And in 1847, certain churches were being persecuted by the King of Holland. And among the persecuted pastors was a gent by the name of Heinrich Peter Schulte. And Schulte was a wealthy guy. His parents owned a box and crate-making company in Holland. So, and Holland at the time was one of the centers of commerce in the world. But Schulte was unhappy because the King of Holland had imposed a state religion on the Dutch, and he wanted to pay the clergy, and he wanted to determine what the clergy could preach about. And many of the Dutch clergy resented that and thought it was an imposition of state control on what should be a free institution. So after a bit of trouble with the authorities in Holland, Schulte and about 800 settlers got on a steamer, came across the ocean, and ultimately found a place in Pella, Iowa, where they bought acres and acres and acres of land in what has become what then became Pella, Iowa. And it's one of the most authentically Dutch places I've ever been. So if you go down to the charming downtown, there are more windmills here than I've ever seen in my life. I mean, the old-fashioned kind that you see in the old pictures. The people here are just lovely. And the whole environment speaks of a different age, even, where things were simpler and people were just nicer to each other. I rented a car to come here, and I don't even want to speed because everybody is so courteous on the road. So we are I am in the city of refuge right now, in Pella, where these 800 Dutch settlers came and they built a life and they built a town, and it has flourished as a lovely and charming place. If you haven't been here, yes, and I'm guessing most of you haven't, it really is worth a visit if you're doing a tour of the United States. One little factoid that's sort of interesting, although it has nothing to do with religion, is that Wyatt Earp, the one who would be the guy who would later become a famous lawman, grew up here. He was a kid in Pella, and there's a house where he lived as a child is still preserved in the downtown area, which is quite small and quite lovely.
Pastor Rich?
Yes.
I hate to interrupt, but you do have a caller whenever you'd like to take it.
I would love to take it now. Thank you. Hi, caller.
All righty, Jimmy, Hello. You're on.
Yeah, good morning, Pastor. Okay, it's always Jimmy, so nice to hear some piece of history, even if it's religious history, which connects to secularism. So it's nice. Okay, thank you for that. Okay. I have a question to ask you, okay? If you look on the history of mankind, and I say specifically mm-hmm. mankind, okay, is there, at what year, time, people start practicing what we considered the modern religious that are okay, and I'm not singling anyone in particular, okay, but when they started following those main religions as we call them now, how far back?
That's an interesting question. I think the answer goes way back, but it would differ for different religious traditions.
Well, I'm asking you, so...
so, for example, for the Jews, it goes back to the time when Moses gave the Jews the Torah.
Would you have a date?
Oh, gee, I would say that's... I'm asking for a date. I'm guessing 5,000 years or so before Christ, before the Common Era. So the Judaism goes way, way, way back. The practice of some Eastern religions, Hinduism, and Hinduism especially goes quite far back, as does Buddhism. I mean, the Buddha, I think, is just picking the date out of the air if I tried to figure out Buddhism, but out of Judaism, which is basically the Torah and then the wisdom literature, the Psalms and the Proverbs and the Prophets. After Judaism, or out of Judaism, comes Christianity. So Christianity doesn't. Early Christians considered themselves Messianic Jews, and they would go to the temple on Saturday, or they would have a Sabbath worship on Saturday, Sabbath practice on Saturdays, and then on Sundays they'd celebrate the resurrection by doing a communion service and gathering together as Christians. That ended around 90 AD when there was a real rift between Christians and Jews, in part caused by the destruction of the temple. Prior to the destruction of the temple, Judaism, and if Rabbi Kurland or anybody else, please call in if I'm getting this wrong, but Judaism was a very pluriform religion. There were Sadducees and Essenes. And there's all sorts of different ways and practices in Judaism that were sort of accepted and that were gathered around temple worship. The Pharisees, Pharisaic Judaism, didn't tend to be temple-based. They had synagogues in different towns so that people could come and preach and hear the word of God locally and not have to go to Jerusalem and the temple, of course. When the temple was destroyed, a lot of the sects of Judaism, like the Sadducees, that relied on temple worship and the temple's existence, they disappeared. That's 70 A.D., so after that, the Christians who weren't temple based in the temple, they gathered in homes, and also spent time in synagogues, And that the stronger group were the Pharisaic Jews. There was a split between them around, I think, 90 AD or so. And the two different ways of being Jewish went their separate ways. Jewish Christians tended not to thrive as well as the Christians among the Gentiles who were converted by Paul the Apostle. But Christianity then as an institution begins to grow up separately from Judaism. I mean, without being a church historian by any measure, I would say that whole situation starts around 90 AD. That help?
Well, that's interesting. Now, let me complicate things for you a little bit more, okay?
Oh, there you go.
Well, you know, it's interesting. It's something people generally don't talk about it, but kind of add flavor to the stew, as they say. Now, if we really talk about man as it is, and we throw in evolution here, or the prehistorical, man, and please, ladies, when I say men, I mean men and women, okay? How does it relate to the start of religious as we know it?
If you're asking me to go back to prehistory or to early historic times, I think there's always been in human nature a desire to connect with that which is ultimate. So it is of the nature of mankind, again, by which I mean men and women, it's of the nature of mankind to seek to go beyond itself, because we are, in Heidegger's words, mankind is being unto death. We confront our own mortality by being human, but it's impossible to think of non-being. So I mean, we can't think of ourselves as not existing. I mean, I know I didn't exist in 1750, for example. But so for me, history starts in the 20th century. But I can't conceive of myself not being here or not being somewhere, because the human spirit is, I think, longs for the eternal. And it's in that quest for the eternal that we find the impulse to find the one who is eternal and who can give us eternal life, and that's God. So I think from the very beginning, humankind tries to find some type of connection to the ultimate, you know, to the one who makes it rain, to the one who makes the thunder claps loud and the lightning bolts flash. And the initial theology of those people is quite rudimentary. You know, they built idols of clay and stone. They were trying to find a way to make the randomness in nature somewhat predictable and controllable. And so if God or the gods control the volcano, well, then let's pray to the god of the volcano so that it doesn't erupt. But in that, there's a very genuine instinct that there is something beyond the volcano that is lord of the volcano. And I think you still find that in Christianity and Judaism when we say God is sovereign. The Lord is king over all the earth, the psalmist said. And so he is. And so we can still bring our prayers and our petitions to God, trusting that the one who created not only the volcano, but everything that is also the one who hears our prayers and listens to them. And I think as religion evolved, humankind is reaching out to try to understand religion and understand the ultimate, understand God. And but by the way, the word religion is rooted in the Latin words to reconnect. So the impulse, the religious impulse, is an impulse to reconnect to the essence of life, to things the way they are. But over time, religious geniuses, such as Moses, began to, Abraham, Jesus himself, began to realize that the ultimate is the one who reveals himself to us as well. And how does God reveal himself? Well, sometimes he reveals himself primarily in everything around us. You know, the earth is full of the goodness of God. I think that's the psalmist as well. So we can find, I'm sitting at a table in the beautiful Cheesemaker's Inn in Pella, Iowa, and there are lovely flowers on the table here. And those flowers speak to me of the beauty of the one who made the flowers. So everyone has an access to God through the nature that surrounds us. All we have to do is think about it. All we have to do is, you know, you can't hear something that you're not listening for, unless it's really loud and clunks you over the head with the sound. So if we look at nature and begin to wonder about it, that's the beginning of the religious impulse, I think, for some people. But Moses and Abraham, they begin to experience the self-revelation of God as God. So, you know, they're going to say, you know, the Lord spoke to me and said, hey, you know, here are 10 commandments, use them. And P.S., they're not 10 suggestions, they're 10 commandments. So do they constrain you? Well, if I'm a faithful Jew, I bless the Lord for Torah. I bless the Lord for every law in the Jewish Bible, because those laws are the way that my spirit is freed. The law gives freedom; it doesn't bring constraint, because it shows me the way to life, and the only place you find life is in God and God's will. If I'm looking for life where there is death, I'm sure not going to find it. If I'm looking for life in sinfulness, I'm not going to find life there. If I'm looking for life in greed, if money is my God, or any idolatry, and anything we put in God's place leads us away from the spirit of life itself. So if I'm steeped in greed or in lust or in any of the vices that you can think of, if I'm looking for my joy and my pleasure in having things and stuff, I'm missing the boat, because God says in his law, and Jesus says in the law that sums up the law, says, love your neighbor as yourself. Love God above all things. Love your enemy and do good to those who hate you. And it's that love that transcends selfishness that sets the spirit free. And that's the freedom that is to be found in the law. You know, freedom isn't I can do anything I want. The freedom that sets the spirit of man free is the spirit that brings us to the will of God and gives us the strength and the courage to follow it, no matter where it leads us. That makes sense?
Yeah, it's fascinating. Okay, I always learn something when I'm listening to you. Okay, you know, you talk about 10 commandments. It brings something that I guess I would call it the American 10 commandments, which is the Constitution. Okay, its geniuses came and set some points, commandments, regulation, anywhere how people define it here. But it's something to follow and something that would make society a better place here. And I think there is sort of, this is more secular, and there we talk about religion, but in essence, there is some kind of a correlation, I personally believe. I think the people who came with the Constitution, they were way ahead of their time. Their work is just, I'm very sad that a lot of people don't even get it to this day, and they rebuke it, which is sad, okay? So.
Well, I hear you, because the Constitution was really a moment of political genius. The array of founding fathers and their brilliance and their rootedness in faith, every one of them, in one way or another, a believer in the God who set everything into motion. Every one of them familiar with Latin and Greek and Hebrew and the scriptures. So when they come to set forth the Constitution or the founding document, they write the founding documents, the Declaration being, I think, one of the most beautiful documents I've ever read of a political nature. They are basically saying the human person is not the creation of the state. So government has its limits. Government can't put itself in the place of God. Government cannot be an idol. And so human beings, as human beings, have freedom that is given to them by God and that cannot be taken from them by the state without the state violating God's will and plan. So the government, the state government, the federal government, its place is to serve, to help create an ordered liberty so that people can go about their lives following their best insights and pursuing life and liberty and security and property. Now, how do you pursue life? Well, from my perspective, you pursue life by pursuing the author of life. And how do you pursue liberty? You pursue liberty by keeping government at bay. The king was no friend of the liberty of the king's people back in the time of George III. And you can look around the world and see the tyrants of this world, by and large, oppress and hate religion, because religion says to them, hey, there's something more important than you. You're not the boss of bosses. Only in God is my soul at rest. In him is my salvation. So you look around the world and you see a tyranny. I mean, the ultimate tyranny right now, I think, is communist China. In communist China, everything religious is persecuted or controlled. So even the Catholic Church, which at one time in its existence had far more courage, even the Catholic Church has entered into an agreement with the Communist Party in China to allow the Communist Party to name its bishops. Well, that's, you name a bishop in the Catholic Church because of its hierarchical structure. You control the bishop, you control everything below the bishop. So it's the Catholic Church has essentially forsaken its prophetic mission in China, which is to say to a government who oppresses its people, who enslaves its people, which mines the organs of its dissidents and kills them to sell those organs on the world market. The Catholic Church is saying, be tame. You know, follow the rules. Don't make waves. But every religious voice in China, including Falun Gong, including the Uyghurs, which is a sect of Islam, and Christians who won't be cowed and who won't be controlled by the central government and its evil, they are harassed, they're arrested, they're imprisoned, they're tortured, and they're killed. And we still buy sneakers from those people.
Mm. Right. Well said.
So the Constitution ensures or attempts to ensure for us freedom from that kind of tyranny. And that is a tremendous blessing as long as we're faithful to it. Benjamin Franklin was coming out of the Constitutional Convention. And a woman said to him, Dr. Franklin, what have you done for us? And he said, we've given you a republic if you can keep it. So can we keep our freedoms? And that means can we make sure that our leaders, our political leaders, are servants and not our masters. You know, some of the troubling things that we've seen during the so-called pandemic are these mandates that come from on high that say to people, this is what's going to happen to you no matter what. You must have take a vaccine that is still experimental. It's only given preliminary authorization by the whoever gives those, Department of Health, I guess, or Health and Human Services. Well, somebody can tell me who exactly approves these things, but it's not approved permanently. It's a stopgap measure, and we're seeing more and more examples of the adverse impact of the vaccine and its and the boosters. We're seeing young people getting myocarditis. A friend of mine just dropped out of a heart attack at the age of 70. So after getting a booster, so there are reasons for people to say, "I'm not sure I want that." And in that type of situation, do we want people compelled to take a shot or lose their jobs, their livelihoods, their opportunities? You know, I think that's troubling. You know, same thing with these mask mandates, when we know that the mask really doesn't do that much to keep us safe and does some things that are harmful to our health. So you know, we need to not let our government overreach, or we too will become slaves, as the people in China have become slaves. Jimmy, did that help?
He is gone.
Oh, Jimmy's gone. Well, bye, Jimmy. Am I still, is the audio still okay?
Yeah. Okay, you're still good. Coming through crystal clear.
See, this is my first time on the phone, so this is a very exciting thing. I'd like to talk more about the General Synod, because loads of things are happening at it that are worth sharing, I think. And one is that a theme sort of emerges at the Synod, and that theme is the question of God: what would you have me do? And it's the question the Reformed Church is asking right now, because it's at a crossroads of its history. A lot of churches are dwindling; they're getting smaller and smaller. They're closing, or they're leaving the denomination for one reason or another. And so, at this time of turmoil within the denomination, the Reformed Church in America, which, by the way, is one of the oldest denominations, it's probably the oldest denomination in the United States, going back to when Peter Stuyvesant and the Dutch settlers came to Manhattan back in the 1600s. Where are things going for the denomination? But I'd like to expand that question for all of us. Where are we going? What is God asking of us? Because in every day of our lives, we have the opportunity to do the will of God. But we need to know what it is. And to know what it is, in some detail, we have to ask God the question, what would you have me do? And in partial answer to that question, at least at the Synod, we've heard multiple times a reading from the prophet Micah. These things the Lord asks us, only this: to love justice, to live mercifully, and to walk humbly with our God. So in any given day, there's a small road map. If we aren't doing those things, we're probably not heading in the right direction. So to live justly, what is justice? What is justice? I mean, in some ways, it's different things for different people. And I hear a lot of folks who feel they have not been treated, or their ancestors haven't been treated justly over the course of history for one reason or another, saying justice is reparations, or justice is me getting an apology from somebody else who owes me an apology, or something like that. And that's not terribly convincing in this sense. The, the prophet isn't saying demand the justice of others. The prophet is saying do justice yourself. So it's not, you know, who stepped on my coattails. I mean, I have some Irish ancestry, and I suppose I could say, gee, that the English treated the Irish terribly back in the 1800s. But, you know, you can't do much to change history. And in any event, that doesn't tell me anything about how I must do justice. So how do I do justice in the small acts and sometimes the large ones of my life, today, tomorrow, and moving forward? John Rawls, the philosopher who taught at one time at Harvard, wrote, this goes back about 20, 30 years, he wrote a book entitled The Theory of Justice. And in The Theory of Justice, Rawls says that to understand justice, we need to put ourselves behind a veil of ignorance, by which he means we have to pretend, I suppose is the best way to put it, that we don't know things about ourselves that we really do know. We don't know our age. We don't know our race. We don't know our sex. We don't know our nation of origin. We don't know where we live. We don't know how wealthy or poor we are. We don't know any of the details of where we are in the world, what our, and his word, not mine, what our thrownness is. And thrownness is where we find ourselves. We, you know, once we're born, we have a package of things that we've just been thrown into. We didn't choose them, but there we are. I'm a man, not a woman. I'm in North America, not South America. I speak English and not Portuguese, and on it goes. So we don't know any of those details about ourselves. Then he says, what rules for interaction would we create to be a model for each other? You know, how do we set the standards for our society and for our own practice, not knowing whether or not I benefit or am burdened by the rule I create? So is justice really, and let me simplify that veil of ignorance stuff, is justice basically letting go of our ego and our ego self and what we want and desire and saying, I must do for others what is best for them, regardless of the cost to me? And, you know, that's not a bad definition of justice, giving other people what is their due, because it is their due, according in my judgment, based on my faith that every person is, as a created being, in some way an image of God, an image bearer of the divine. So to do justice is to let go of what I want. It's to let go of my demands, you know. Justice for me is behaving nicer to me. Well, you know, that might be nice, but you don't get to set those standards. That's sort of demanding, but it's not behaving in a just way towards others. Justice is forgiving and blessing those who aren't terribly nice to us. That's a decent way to be just, is to give people their due whether I want to or not. And their due is the respect that is theirs as created beings in God's image. God loves every stinking thing he created, from the smallest grain of sand to the biggest star. And the people he made, our brothers and our sisters, they are the masterpieces of his creation. And maybe those masterpieces have become tarnished for one reason or another. But whatever they are beloved by God, and we must be kind to them. That is just. That is just. Micah goes on, to have mercy. Mercy is forbearance. Mercy is letting go of the demands we might have. You know, mercy is understanding the limitations of others. Mercy is saying, okay, that person who's driving too slow in front of me, maybe they're afraid. Maybe that's an old person who can't see all that well but is trying to get to the drugstore to get his or her meds. So mercy is forbearance. Don't sit on the horn. Don't wave with that, you know, that special wave that only uses one finger. But allow for people's frailties. You know, some people are constrained by disabilities. That's okay. If they have to hobble up the stairway, they have to hobble up. And if that slows you down, well, maybe God's slowing you down for a reason. And maybe the reason is that if you went too fast, you would miss something of beauty that you will pass along the way. And perhaps the thing of beauty that you would miss is the person who is slowing you down, himself or herself. And the last thing Micah says is to walk humbly with God. And the word humble comes from the Latin word humus, which means soil, dirt, dust. And, you know, I dirt's taken a bad rap over the past few millennia, but dirt is that without which we could not live. Because everything that sustains us in one way or another comes from the earth. You know, the bread that we eat came from the wheat that grew in soil. The trees that were in, I'm sitting again in the Cheesemaker's Inn in beautiful Pella, and I'm watching the trees blowing in the wind, and they're rooted in soil. And so soil is that which gives life. And when we are humble, don't we root ourselves in the realization that we too grow from not aggrandizing ourselves, but from seeing ourselves as that which the Lord is working on. To and from which will grow something beautiful for God. So to love justice, to live with mercy, and to walk with humility and with our God. So walking with humility with our God involves realizing that we are never alone. That when we are confused, we walk with the one who knows. When we can't really figure out what's true, we walk with the one who is the truth, who anchors truth, who guarantees truth. And from that walk, we realize there is truth. It's not just all narrative. There is truth, and it's the truth that sets us free. And so the take home there is when we go through life as Micah suggests, then we are in a place where we can discern. And discernment is really what's God asking of me, and how do I know He's really asking it? And that requires a listening heart. That requires the quiet to realize that the Spirit really does lead us. And where the Spirit leads us to is a good place. And where the Spirit leads, He also provides. So we will never want when we follow where God is calling us. Doesn't mean we won't suffer. It doesn't mean we won't be persecuted. Just look at the Christians in China. But it means that it will be okay. And that's something that God guarantees. I have a little story for you about a friend I met here at the synod. His name is Dennis Mugabo, and he is a Rwandan refugee who lives in Canada. And he's also someone who's very active in the church in Rwanda. He goes there probably half a year or more. But Dennis was telling a story yesterday about coming to Canada and being warned by other Rwandan refugees to stay away from those big guys with the tattoos because they're rednecks and they'll harm you. And Dennis believed that for a long time. And then, as he tells the story, he went to a bar, and there were a bunch of those big white guys with tattoos. And one of them came up to him and says, "What do you want?" And Dennis, he said he was afraid because he'd heard all those stories about how the big guys with tattoos would beat him up and treat him badly. So Dennis said, "I'm looking for rednecks." He said that innocently, too. He didn't realize it might have been taken wrong. And so the guy said, "What do you want with the rednecks?" And Dennis said, "I want to be a black redneck." So the guys that he met that day said, "Well, come with us." They gave him a hat, one of those cowboy hats. They brought him to a barbecue place, and they had dinner together. All by way of saying that we discern where God's spirit is by having the courage to break down our stereotypes. You know, Dennis could never have had that experience had he not had the courage to confront his fears. And I think one of the things that story reminds me is how important it is to have the courage to confront my own fears. And I'd like to share that with everybody listening today, because I think it's an important message from the Lord, who tells us to do not be afraid over and over and over in scriptures, in the Jewish Bible and in the New Testament. Do not be afraid. Why not? Because we are never alone. As the psalmist says in Psalm 23, when you walk through the dark valley, when I walk through the dark valley, you are with me. Your hook and your staff, they comfort me. So don't forget the guy in that dark valley is you. And the guy in the dark valley is me. And the one who walks with us is the Lord, who is our shepherd. And our shepherd is also our friend and our creator, who loves us more than anyone else ever could. I had another experience with Dennis. As I said, he's planning to go back to Rwanda in October. And he came to me and he said, "Would you like to come?" Well, now we're talking about confronting fear, right? Because Rwanda, Hutus, Tutsis, beheadings, all that, all those bad things that I've heard about Rwanda. So I said, "Yeah." I hemmed and I hawed a little bit, and I said, "Well, yeah, I guess I'd come." Then the other day, I was sitting at a table before our general session started of the Senate, and I was reading from St. Paul. And here's the passage I was reading, and this is exactly what I had read when Dennis came over. Paul, this is in Paul, Paul to Romans chapter 10, towards the end. Paul writes, "Everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved." Everyone. But then he goes on, "How can they call on the one they have not believed in?" Makes sense, right? "And how can they believe in the one of whom they have not heard? And how can they hear without someone preaching to them? And how can anyone preach unless they are sent?" Okay, so I just finished. The passage goes on, as it is written, "How beautiful are the feet of those who bring good news. I had just finished reading that to myself. I mean, I was just sitting at the table reading. And Dennis came over and he said, when you come in October, I want you to preach. And I thought to myself, well, first of all, he doesn't know if I'm a good preacher or a bad preacher or what. I mean, he knows me a little bit from talking, but he came over and he asked that, and I thought to myself, these things aren't coincidental. And so that invitation was really an invitation, I think, that was confirmed by God's Spirit, who had me sitting there with my nose in Romans 10, reading something that I had absolutely no expectation would result in an invitation to go halfway around the world to preach to people I don't know about the peace of the gospel, in which I believe deeply. But this is also a very humbling invitation, and I intend to take him up on it. So, Dennis, I know you're not listening because we are not being broadcast in Pella, Iowa, but thank you for your invitation, and it is a very humbling thing to be asked.
Well, don't count on, we are also broadcasting on the internet. I hate to interrupt again, Pastor Rich, but you do have another phone call. We've got Franny on the line.
Franny, how are you?
Hi, Pastor Rich.
How are you, Franny?
Okay, the sermon was very good today. And also, are you a father? You have children?
I have stepchildren.
Oh, okay. Well, I want to wish you a happy Father's Day. And all the fathers in the world.
Oh, thank you very much.
Okay,
right.
I just wanted to say that.
Oh, you're the best. Now, were you away last week?
What, Richie? What, Father?
Were you away last week?
Was I away last week?
Yes.
No. Let's see.
I thought you were.
Maybe I was sleeping, or my sister been in. Well, I had surgery, and she was in the nursing home. Maybe I was back and forth, but she's coming back home today. She had a foot surgery, but a lot of pain. So,
well,
you can
thank
pray
you
for
calling,
her, too.
And thank you for reminding me of Father's Day, because we should say a word about fathers before our time.
Okay, go ahead. I'll let you go.
Thanks a million, Franny. God bless you.
God bless. Bye-bye.
Yes, Father's Day is coming up, and where would we be without our fathers? Well, the answer is we wouldn't be anywhere, because we need them for life itself. They're the ones who give us life and help sustain us. And there was a story I heard years ago about women in a prison. And it was Father's Day, and the preacher was going on about fathers this and fathers that, and he could see all the blank faces. And so he asked them, what does father mean to you? And every one of them had a bad experience with her father. And so he switched. And he said, what would you have liked your father to be like? And one said, well, he would help me. And he would accept me. And he would guide me, and he would stick up for me, even when I was wrong. Even when I was wrong. And what they were describing is the fatherhood of God, from whom all human fathers take their name. So my father was just a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful man. His name was Alfred, and he was kind, he was smart, he was very quiet. He was loving, he was encouraging. If I sat around trying to think of one bad thing about him, I wouldn't be able to tell you. I never saw him argue with my mother. He treated her like a queen. She would never open a door because he could get there first, usually, at least when he was there. He would never open a door. And he loved her. He loved my sister and I. And he was just a wonderful man. So I'm very grateful to him, and I'm grateful to all fathers who have given life and sustenance to their kids. It's perfectly appropriate that we have a day to celebrate fathers. I know there's a terrible hole in our hearts once they leave us, and that hole will never go away. It'll get easier. But for those of us who still, for those who still have their fathers with them, please let them know how much you love them, and make the day special for them, because they're often forgotten. Mother's Day is a big thing, and that's also a very appropriate celebration of moms. But sometimes dads get lost in the sauce, and it's really good to take the time to celebrate them and to celebrate their love.
Hey, Pastor Rich.
And make sure that they know they are loved. Yes.
I know we've got just a couple minutes left, but we do have one more caller for you if you want to take it.
Bring it on. Sure.
You're on with Pastor Rich.
Oh, hello, Pastor Rich.
Hey,
this is Lori. How are you?
Absolutely. I'm great. How are you? Thanks for calling.
Wonderful. I was going to call earlier, but I was just mesmerized listening to you.
Hope that's your first.
Anyway, Sunday was fabulous. We missed you at the service, and Sandy
Thank
did a fabulous
much.
Job.
Well, I'm not surprised, because Sandy is a fabulous person.
Absolutely.
And I missed everybody. I was praying for you all, but I'm looking forward to being back next Sunday.
Oh, absolutely. Were you listening to us on stream? Were you streaming us?
No, I could. I was at a service here in Pella that they had for the Synod, so I couldn't get to my computer. But I'm going to go back and look at it at some point.
I figured if you could have, you would have been there.
No, I would have been there if I could have.
But but have a wonderful trip. Safe travels
you
on your way
much.
Home.
Thanks for calling. Love you. Love Jeff.
You're welcome. Love you too.
Whole,
and we'll see you Sunday.
Clarkstown Reformed Church community. I would be remiss if I didn't remind all of our listeners that our service is at 10:30 on Sunday mornings. Everybody's welcome. And coming up, we have a healing service on the last Saturday of the month. And without a calendar in front of me, I think it's the Saturday after the Saturday. And on July 3rd, we have a baseball game at Clover Stadium, I guess it's called. And it starts at 3:30 with a tailgate, and then the game is at 6. Our own Ava Aston, who sings at church, will be singing the Star Spangled Banner, and then we will all be rooting for the home team. So we look forward to seeing as many of you there as you'd like to come. I hear our music. God bless you all, and I'll talk to you next week from the studio.
Bless you, see you Sunday.
Bye now.